This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, we're talking with Mike Sokolow. He teaches journalism and history at the University of Maine and has written extensively on past episodes of media hysteria and distortion, particularly around the 1936 Olympic Games. Fascinating read and a pretty good journalist himself. Look for his byline all over the place. I am talking to him specifically about a piece he had a while ago in the New York Times, which talked about how to prevent smart people from spreading dumb ideas. And it was an interesting foray into a world that I guess is coming up, which is media literacy for a social media age, for an age of fake news. Mike, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
So let's set the scene and then kind of run through the basic argument of your or the points of your Times piece, and we'll kind of go out from there. But you know, we live in a world now where people are bombarded by all sorts of news from every possible source, and now we're learning that there is fake news, which is somewhat defined in various ways. But you know, it could be Russian trolls trying to leak information that may or may not be true to affect elections. It could be, just stories that are made up for people that are having fun, just bad news. What's going on with fake news, and why is it a particular concern in contemporary America?
Well, first of all, I think for obvious reasons, the term fake news is a little problematic because it's always been around. It's always existed. I think what's new is the way we behave and the way we react to what's called fake news or to problematic news or even to bad news. You know, I think once upon a time, we were sort of forced, whether it was through the big magazines, the daily newspapers, or the three evening newscasts, we were forced to deal with and accept and at least process to some extent and even reject bad news or news we didn't want to hear. I think what's different about today and what's different about social media is we're able to now build a news ecosystem that removes the bad news, the news we don't want to see, from our consciousness. And I think that's sort of problematic, and we need to be aware of that, and we need to figure out how we're going to go back to a world that's more balanced.
Now, why is it, why is it bad to have a news filter that gets you the news that you want?
Well, I mean, everybody goes back to the Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote, right? You're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your facts. And it presumes a basis, a very simple basis of factual accuracy that we will all argue over, and that's evaporating. The idea of actual events, actual things occurring, and I used a specific example in my New York Times piece of an event that did not happen, that was retweeted 46,000 times and had reach of millions of people and convinced them that it did happen. So we're into a sort of a new territory in that sense around the basis of factual accuracy.
What about events? I mean, you know, clearly there's things like that don't happen. But then what about things where what happens is subject to intense ambiguity. So, and I think about this in a lot of the cases that deal with criminal justice outrage, when a cop kills somebody who may or may not have a gun, or who may have been reaching for a gun, and the cop says, "I thought it was a gun," and the situation is ambiguous. How are we dealing with those kinds of situations? Because part of what's going on, in the same way that we have more perspectives than ever, sometimes that ends up letting us see an event in a way that we wouldn't have before. So there have been times where, say, a cop says, and this is the traditional narrative after a shooting of a citizen by a cop, the cop says, "I thought he had a gun," or "he was lunging at me." But now we have more cases where other people with cameras actually document that the police was acting in bad faith. How does that factor into the sense that the news we're getting is all very motivated by the person telling the news?
Right. Well, I don't see it as chicken and egg. I see definitely the filter comes first. In other words, the algorithm is built for us, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, whatever it is that we use for our social sharing. It could even just be an email from a friend, right? Or it could be a link from YouTube, whatever it is. That comes before the ambiguity that you're describing. And I actually was the advisor on a 2012 PhD dissertation here at the University of Maine in communication called Cops, Camera, and Accountability. And the student looked at case studies of exactly this. It was case studies of civilian police interaction caught and uploaded to YouTube, or not necessarily. There were 12 or 14 case studies. One or two we chose did not go to YouTube because the cops confiscated the actual cell phones, and to do sort of a comparison. And what we found was really fascinating about what we found about the interpretation, and it's now a book, by the way. It's called Cops, Camera, and Accountability by Douglas Kelly. We found that, number one, YouTube completely changed the dynamic, okay? The ability to counter the police by spreading your own video is new, and YouTube is a tool of empowerment for civil liberties. It wasn't designed as this, but it has become that to an extent that nobody would have realized. But the second thing that he found, which I thought was very interesting, he found many things, was that the possession of the physical video plays a huge role. And how the and you have to follow the chain of command and how it works. So in other words, if you take, for instance, this Philadelphia Starbucks case that just popped up a day or two ago, that's whatever. His ultimate finding was that the police need cameras. The only way the police are ever going to counter the narratives that are going to be put out there because of the filters that we've discussed earlier is to have their own video, period. There's no other defense that they will be able to counter. So, and for a variety of reasons. I mean, it's complicated, and it goes into whether they would even want to show the video, right? But simply the existence of the police video will give them something to place in that algorithmic frame that their supporters need. Are you following this? So,
yeah, so totally.
It's kind of complicated, but in other words, a way of saying this is, let's say the worst and most obvious case of police brutality, like the Tamir Rice case in Cleveland. The people who want to support a version of events that aren't the Black Lives Matter require video, period. It doesn't even matter if it shows it terrible. That was his big finding. And it's fascinating because the police haven't caught up on that.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are moving towards that. And, of course, cops, were pushing to have dash cams for traffic stops for a long time. And I've read reports where, you know, it's upwards of 80% or higher that the dash cam footage exonerates the police because, you know, a lot of the times people who are in, being arrested or being pulled over, you know, believe in their innocence and they assert it, but sometimes it's not there on the tape. Now, of course, we get to the point, though, and, you know, I'm a fan of kind of like Michelangelo Antonioni films from the 60s, like Blow Up, and, you know, where you have film or you have documentation, but it seems to very quickly become obscure and indecisive or inconclusive. On a social level, is the influx of multiple points of view, all of which have a claim on our truth, is it helping ultimately, or is it just causing more confusion?
That's a great question, and I was only thinking about it from the framing side previously when talking about the police. But you can look at like the Rodney King case, which mm-hmm. predates all of this.
Yeah,
right. That in other words, the video was shown to 12 people in a room. And the lawyers were brilliant about it because they showed it over and over and over, the defense lawyers, over and over and over again, constantly. They slowed it down. They sped it up to the point that the jurors were just completely overwhelmed with the situation and the video and were willing to accept any interpretation, which totally knocked off the prosecutor's version of events, which was very simple. Watch the tape and believe what you see.
Right, right. And there's that whole embedding of the jurors, the people watching, like that beating took place in a particular time and context where the LAPD were known to be, you know, on the one hand, the LAPD were known to treat people as if, they were an occupying army. So they acted in particular ways that might have alleviated some of their guilt, or it might have intensified it, depending on what side of that argument you were on. And that certainly factored in.
So it's like reader. It's kind of like reader response. You know, it's like the. In other words, what you see in the video was individualized even before social media. I guess that was my point.
Right.
Before social media made it so easy to put your own spin on it, we already did this with things like the Rodney King tape. But then what social media does is it actually removes any counter context. In other words, when you watch the Rodney King tape back in the old days, you had to see it on CNN. You had to see two people argue over it. Today, you don't get that. You actually just get the tape and you decide what you want.
Well, let's talk, you know, in the Times piece, you offer three basic steps to be a better, have better media literacy about social media is probably too broad a term, but for the news environment that we're in now, you know, in the past, it might have been you if you wanted to up people's media literacy so that they understood, you know, how to be a critical reader, say, of the New York Times or the Daily News or whatever, these are the things you would do. Your piece is talking about that in the world we live in now. And you say, like, you know, how to make sure you're not part of the problem of just forwarding or believing and acting on fake news accounts. And the first thing that you talk about is you say, you know, if the problem is crowdsourced, then it seems obvious the solution will have to be crowdsourced as well. With that in mind, here are three easy steps each of us can take to help build a better civic polity. The advice will also help each of us look a little less foolish. And the first one is no link, not news. Explain what you mean by that.
What I mean is, at a certain point, when we get reports on anything, whether it's President Trump or Syria bombing, there has to be a level of credibility and authority attached to the information for us to forward it or to endorse it with our own credibility. Think about it for a minute. If your neighbor says they know something that happened in the bombing in Syria on your social media, mm-hmm. first question should be, how on earth would my neighbor know that, right? And if your neighbor is just spouting off and there's no link, then if you forward that, if you like it, if you retweet it, then you are now endorsing something that has probably very little basis in fact. And so my argument is that you need to look for a link to something credible or authoritative whenever retweeting or liking or doing anything on social media about a story that's large and outside of your own immediate experience and environment, which is basically every news story.
Yeah, but this is, we're living in the golden age of the amateur, you know, structural engineer, right? Since 9/11, where everybody suddenly went to school for, you know, the basic facts of, you know, that jet fuel can or cannot burn structural steel and all of that kind of stuff. So I think we all feel a little bit more expert in topics that we have absolutely no knowledge of.
That, what you just described is the greatest call for modesty on social media I think I've ever heard. Exactly. Whether it's Loose Change and that crazy documentary or Alex Jones or whatever. I'm not sure. This gets to a larger question about being credulous versus being skeptical, which I think is one of my other points, right? And Jesse Walker's United States of Paranoia is a great book.
Right. My recent colleague, Jesse Walker, yes.
It's a great book that gets to just how embedded in our culture this sense of credulity is, you know, that Americans actually, we like to think we're hard-boiled, skeptical, and all those kind of things, but in fact, we are an incredibly credulous people. We're the most religious people on earth, I mean, by church attendance, and that just transfers over into the culture that we look for these answers, and we're so quick to accept them. Skepticism is actually a virtue. We really need it in this news environment.
And talk a little bit about how you talk about how Facebook and Twitter, this is where they build in a very subtle way credulity, because they are passing you things that you're interested in, that you want to hear from a point of view that you want to hear. So you're getting a lot of confirmation that your understanding of the world is essentially right.
Exactly. Facebook and Twitter are incredible confirmation bias machines. That's what they exist to do. In other words, to keep you engaged, they constantly tell you things you already know. And if you think about that, that's my second point, right? Which is, if you read something and it totally fits your worldview and it confirms exactly what you suspected, then that's exactly when you should pause and think before you hit retweet or like or that kind of thing. Because you have to understand, the entire system has been built to give you that. That's where the endorphins hit your brain, because they confirm how smart you are. And they feed into, you know, your worldview. You're obviously intelligent and informed, and it's a very flattering thing when the thing you suspected and tweeted about the day before now apparently is true because your neighbor has confirmed it. It's a bizarre system. I don't entirely blame the user, but I do think we need to be much more skeptical of what we're so certain about in this current environment, especially since we're being manipulated in the sense our news feeds are being manipulated according to our own behavior. And then that is then taken to the next step and exploited by organizations, people, politicians, and consumers who want to take advantage of our own behavior and actually purchase that from Facebook and Twitter.
So you mentioned in the piece, you mentioned Cambridge Analytica, which is kind of the next step up, because they you know, they have people out there, they look at us and we have certain trend lines and processes going on, and then they want to take advantage of that to sell a particular political message or candidate. And, you know, I assume they're also, you know, in other areas they're selling soap or shoes or something. How effective is that? Because, you know, when it comes down to the Cambridge Analytica story, and, you know, nobody really knows the full extent of things, but in the end, they are like, is the question for something like Cambridge Analytica, are they turning new people? Are they creating new Trump supporters, or are they merely reminding people who already agree with Trump that they should vote for him?
Well, the answer to the first part of the question is neither you nor I nor even Cambridge Analytica can accurately give us a full readout of their persuasive power or Facebook. They simply can't, because even if we were able to prove purchases in certain polling places resulted in overperformance of the polls and votes or whatever, there are other factors, right?
Right.
We know years and years of media study show us that rain has a verifiable effect on voting that you know, we have decades and probably a century. So simply the first part of your question is we don't know with Cambridge Analytica. So let's pause there. But what we do know is that Facebook made $40.7 billion in revenue on the same kind of things they're selling last year in 2017, on the same kind of things they're selling Cambridge Analytica, which means that there's a belief in the system, in its persuasive power. And I'm kind of more interested in the belief, even if it's ephemeral and doesn't necessarily work, than in accurately saying it made people vote or not vote. Now, the second part of what you said about the reconfirmation versus the changing people's minds, it's very, very well known. You don't change people's minds. I mean, this is why all the money in the world in politics now is spent on get out the vote. It's spent on negative voting. It's spent on depressing the vote. You're never going to get the committed Hillary Clinton or the committed Donald Trump voter to vote for the other side. And that's a good 30 to 35% in each case of the electorate, right? So that
right.
70% is gone, especially if you're mass comment. So then it becomes a question of micro-targeting. It's a very complex question involving persuasion, behavior, and micro-targeting. In other words, getting down to the level, and we're in a world now where these are individual appeals. They are literally individual appeals. There's Axios. There's other data mining companies that are kind of hidden. Cambridge Analytica just got busted on this. But that are actually designed, and they do, I mean, it sounds crazy. It sounds like something out of science fiction, but they do beta testing on individuals because they can. They have the capacity to actually tell which ads are, and it's not just ads, by the way. It's also what you put on your own timeline, what you share, those kind of things. They have the capacity to measure online behavior incredibly well. Now, how that translates into the polling booth and the supermarket is a different question,
right?
But that's that level of sophistication is astonishing to me.
That's like a super advanced get out the vote phone tree, where somebody in a particular ward would know, you know, Joe Blow hasn't voted in a couple of years, but I know he's on our team, and I'm going to call him and talk to him several times to see if I can get him to actually go out and vote.
Exactly. But here's where it's a little bit different. So I know Joe Blow personally, but I know his mother's phone number.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what Cambridge Analytica
yeah.
would do. In other words, I know that he's, you know, five times more likely to actually go if his mom picks up the phone and calls him than if I do. So let's call his mom. That's the next level of sophistication. In other words, that's the behavioral analytics, that Joe Blow will go vote if we do X, Y, and Z. It's that other level I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. So and that is a blend both of, like, it's a technology of reaching the right people, and then it's a technology of testing or getting the right information to them, the right message. So it's content, it's medium and message.
Exactly. And it's persuasion. It's very basic persuasion.
So the third point in your social media op-ed was titled, Why Am I Talking? And this one I think is one of my favorite piece because, you know, part of it is we're receiving social media and we're being shaped by social media. But of course, we contribute to and participate by writing our own stuff, retweeting, circulating things. Why do you ask, why am I talking? Why should that be in everybody's kind of response, you know, checklist when, you know, is there a link, you know, is there a link? I knew it. And then why am I talking?
Yeah, I got to be honest on this one. The New York Times edited it out. I had a disclaimer. I said, I'm a blabbermouth on Twitter and that I'm embarrassed, but I do tweet too much and that kind of thing. And they edited it out. But the issue is, it's interesting to me that of the three is the one that got picked up the most and sort of retweeted and Facebooked, because that's the one I felt the most ambivalent about for one big reason. I think there is a democratic power to social media that never existed before. And actually, I'd like to go back. I think social media has sort of hurt the democratic power of the web that used to be seen on blogs and the big blogs. In other words, to counter, you remember the Memogate thing with Dan Rather? I mean, that thing came completely out of the blogs. I'm not sure in the social media universe that kind of eruption again is possible. So I'm not 100% sure. But in other words, I am a techno-utopian, and I kind of do see the democratic possibilities of these new technologies. And that one, I'm saying, you know what, let's all pipe down a little bit in terms of democracy. And so that's the one I'm most ambivalent about. But it does seem to me that my timeline is filled with a lot of tweets that really don't help me. You know what I mean? And I couldn't, and I don't want to go keep knocking them down and silencing people. I actually really don't want to do that, or block people. But that's where it came from. My experience of what has happened to my timeline and my Facebook stuff in the last 2 or 3 years, in that sense. And people seem to really resonate with it, which was interesting to me. But it actually could be related to the first point, which is we might be seeing a lot of stuff that doesn't add value because the algorithm gives it to us. I hadn't really thought of it that way.
Yeah, so the algorithm is off, or the algorithm is, I mean, either they are, there's a reason why they want to fill our timeline with garbage, or they don't know what they're doing yet.
Right. Or in other words, it just might be repetitive because they know it's what we want to see, so they repeat things we want to see. But if you're a true old-fashioned newspaper reader or old-fashioned broadcast news watcher, you want to see a wide variety, and maybe the algorithm is throwing that out there. But the other thing about weight and staying quiet or quieting down on social media is I think I think that understanding when we have something of value to add is an important part of media literacy. It's an important part of growing to learn how to use the medium in a certain way. And I want to be clear, if we all learn how to use it better, which you had mentioned in the article in Reason that you had written about, which I liked and which was very persuasive, that would go against the entire business model of Twitter and Facebook. We are being prompted to engage. We are being prompted to do the opposite of waiting. And so it's the cards are kind of stacked against us. But just thinking a little bit more about how we use it, I think, would be helpful.
Yeah, I'm always interested in these moments when a kind of new medium takes over or becomes huge. And then, you know, there's social learning curves, and it takes a while to figure out how to use it well. And one of my favorite examples is when cable TV really went big in the late 80s and early 90s. There was this proliferation of TV shows, including The Simpsons, including Mystery Science Theater 3000, including Beavis and Butthead, that literally taught people how to view TV critically, because we were seeing a lot more of it and we were seeing a lot more news sources. And when you look at those shows, there are endless examples of where the characters are looking at the news, or they're looking at certain reports, and they are making fun of or kind of dissecting and deconstructing the motifs, the forms, the signature moves of television. And I feel like we need that in social media and that you see some of it, but I think we're a long ways away from kind of upping our game of how to understand this medium where we are spending more and more of our time.
Right. And but there's one huge difference between social media and the examples you described, because, for instance, probably the greatest media literacy program in the history of the United States is The Simpsons, right?
Right. Yep.
It's been on now almost 30 years,
yeah,
and it hasn't changed as much. But that came from the perspective of Fox Television, whether we like it or not.
Yeah,
and
that was.
And who gave it to us. And the examples that you have given have also been produced by somebody and broadcast and sent out on the old line model, whereas I do not see Facebook or Twitter actively educating their mm-hmm. audiences. I mean, Fox stood by The Simpsons when the Bush administration attacked when Cosby attacked it.
The Clinton administration, Joe Lieberman attacked it,
sure,
and Bill Bennett.
Sure.
Bill Bennett and Joe Lieberman gave Bart Simpson a Silver Sewer Award for being a bad boy and all that. Yeah,
right. And you could argue that the reason they stood by it was it fit their business model.
Right.
Right. As long as it got the ratings and as long as the advertisers cared, they were okay. They would protect it. Whereas I think the exact opposite is true of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Their business model is reliant on ignorance of media literacy.
Yeah, God, that seems. I guess I'm part of the problem here. I don't want to hear that news because I was about to say, but they have media criticism shows on their, on their channels, and in fact, they don't. There's like each channel has one, half an hour devoted to people jawing about the news. Yeah.
What? Let's say you ran Facebook. Let's say you were Zuckerberg, and somebody produced a video, although their pivot to video has since gone back. But
that's
remember
right,
their big pivot to video when they wanted money and all that? Right? And somebody produced a hilarious, viral, very sardonic thing about a Facebook thing that goes wrong. I don't mm-hmm. know whether it is like a flash mob
right.
and someone has a heart attack. I don't know. Sort of a comedy Facebook thing that made fun because too many people believed what they saw on Facebook. Actually, you could do one right now. Do you remember that the Russian organized protest and counter protest?
Yes. Yeah.
That's comedy. Ultimately, that's comedy, right? The question would be, what would Facebook do if an anti-Facebook, not anti, but a
critical,
critical Facebook thing went viral? And I would love to see if they would ever, what would ever happen with that. But they take themselves far too seriously.
Yeah.
And that, Rupert Murdoch appeared on The Simpsons, and they made fun of him. I don't think I've seen anything remotely like that when it comes to Twitter or Facebook.
And that game has only been up now that Zuckerberg has testified before Congress and has been treated, somewhat like a worthy adversary as well as a partner in regulating social media on some level. It was all vague, but, a number of congressmen asked, would he be willing to help come up with the regulations that will make social media safe for, mom and apple pie? And he said yes. Did you watch the Facebook?
Yes, and it was,
What was your takeaway from those hearings? Because this is another thing where, each media gets its opportunity. So, in the 50s, comic books and TV game shows were hauled before Congress and told they were bad actors. In the 60s, there was, discussion about movie ratings because movie violence and sexuality had gotten out of hand. And then in the 90s, Janet Reno literally threatened cable TV, of which she had no jurisdiction over, that if shows like Law and Order and things didn't clean up their act, she would, regulate cable TV. We're here again. What was your sense of this?
But here's the flip side. My sense as a media historian was deja vu, and I wasn't happy about it for the following reason. And I'm generally a civil libertarian, mm-hmm. and I support libertarian positions on so many things, right? But the one thing the libertarian perspective, I think, has a little bit of a problem with, I'm just going to put this out there, is rent seeking,
mm-hmm.
right? Zuckerberg is up there, and he's the subtext is, I've caused some problems. I've built this machine that's great for building community. Hey, I'm willing to work with you to fix this.
Yep.
You know what the part nobody's talking about is, I'm also willing to work with you so no alternative is given to the public,
yep.
right? So that some startup out there, and this is related to sort of the net neutrality question with rent seeking, so that no startup out there, MySpace can't be revived, or a version of Facebook can't compete with me. This is what Western Union did with the telegraph, right? There were over 1,000 telegraph companies in the United States in the 1850s. And the U.S. government chose Western Union for the Pacific Telegraph Act, gave them $400,000, and within 8 years, they were the only telegraph company. It's what happened with AT&T. AT&T and Theodore Vail went to the government and said, let's stop these farmers from unrolling spools of barbed wire and creating their own telephone networks. Let's build one in the public interest. And the government said, great, let's do that. It happens over and over and over again. And let me give you an example. There's a couple examples here of the libertarian position running into a problem in the rent-seeking thing. When television was going to be introduced by RCA in 1939, 1940, David Sarnoff said, and it did actually go from experimental to commercial, he sewed up all the patents between Zweyerkin and Farnsworth, and the system he introduced, you would have to buy your transmitter from RCA, and you'd have to buy your television receiver from RCA, and it would be set up only to get NBC. And what he said to the FCC was, look, if CBS, DuMont, or any of the other companies want to get into this, let them sell a transmitter. Let them sell a TV. So in other words, the original commercial version of television that was approved in 1940, you would have to have three separate receivers in your house to get CBS, ABC, and NBC. And the FCC stepped in and said, wait a minute, there's no way that that is in the public interest. And that's rent-seeking, by the way.
Right.
That's RCA going to FCC and saying, let's do it this way. And so the FCC set up something called the National Television Standards Committee, NTSC, which basically said, yeah, RCA, you can sell as many transmitters as you want. You can sell as many receivers as you want, but you have to license everybody else to do a version of television that's, you know, whatever, 525 lines that we all agree to in that way. And that's the only answer for rent-seeking. And I see Facebook right now in that area. I see Facebook as desperately seeking some protection and rent seeking from the people they're in front of.
Right. And especially they are having flat growth in the United States, both in terms of their average annual growth is kind of flattening out in terms of revenue and users. But what is the analog to, and I agree with you, and a lot of Reason's coverage was actually about that. We anticipated that Zuckerberg, we used the example of railroad barons, that he was going to Congress to, you know, and he'd already said he was in favor of, you know, the right type of regulation. And they had conversations, open conversations about let's regulate stuff. And at one point, Zuckerberg even said, you know, I do want you to know these regulations will help me and it'll make it harder for people to compete with me. And Congress was okay with that. You know, as long as they, you know, get to write the regulations. But what is the analog of that, of saying, okay, you have to have a TV, a proprietary receiver or transmitter that's open to everybody? What is the analog in this, in the current moment?
That's a great question. I'm not 100% sure, but I am in favor of net neutrality regulation, which I know is the anti-libertarian position, but for exactly this reason, for the rent-seeking of the cable companies, for the rent-seeking that's involved in the regulatory process is so distorted that this is the only way to balance it out. If we're going to get another Facebook or if we're going to get another system, it can only happen in a way where Facebook isn't paying off providers, isn't paying for additional protection, not just from the government.
And in that sense, just to define net neutrality then, I mean, what you're saying is basically that a internet service provider can't block,
exactly,
you know, block a legal site or service online.
And Facebook can't pay them to do that. Yeah.
Right.
But here's another example. You know, it's very funny. Tim Berners-Lee now, the guy who invented the web, started out way back on the libertarian position. If you look at his speeches from 97 to 2002 or 3, they are filled with the kind of things that the libertarian position should be. For instance, here's a very simple thing. He wanted a button on the browser. You can look this up. The button would be called the Oh Yeah button, O-H comma Y-E-A-H question mark. And basically the idea would be if you see something that's too good, whether it's an offer for clothing or shoes from Amazon or fake news, you click this button and the browser would have an algorithmic, would go in and have a way to test other people you trust, Oh Yeah buttons, essentially, at a central server to let you know the relative credibility of what you are seeing on the web, right? That's a perfect example of a non-governmental solution
right.
to everything we've just discussed, the credibility issue, the this or that. Of course, it's totally against what the journalists sell and what the advertisers sell and what Facebook sells. Facebook does not want that button, neither does Twitter. And so Tim Berners-Lee now is all the way on the other side of net neutrality, specifically because these companies have not allowed the tools that are available. These tools are totally available, whether it's credibility, skepticism. You can build them into a browser.
Well, and you would think, don't you think, that in companies like Amazon and even in a way Netflix with reviews and whatnot, that you know people have more information about the products or services they're buying or the individuals they're interacting with. In a lot of contexts, and it seems to be going towards that issue.
Well, I slightly disagree. I would say they have a lot more information that's been curated to what they want to see.
Okay.
In other words, I would argue that Netflix does not show you negative reviews. Actually, mm-hmm. I wouldn't argue this. This is known.
Yeah.
This is provable.
Yeah.
You and me, Nick, we look for the same movie on Netflix. We see different reviews.
Right. But so what is the that is not a issue. That is not an issue of net neutrality per se, because this is, I mean, for me, I guess one of the things I struggle with the net neutrality issue is that it's always framed in terms of, you know, the ISP is the bad guy because they're the you know, they're the toll taker when you're getting on or off the internet, and they're keeping you from the glorious utopia that is Netflix, that is Amazon, that is Google and YouTube and all of that. But all of the examples seem to always come from what's going on. Like Facebook is the entity that's working us all over, not my local ISP.
Right. And let me be clear. I mean, a lot of the overblown rhetoric about net neutrality is a problem on my side, on the side that I support. Because it doesn't give the other side enough credit for being smart. Like, they're not going to show up. You know, when they slow down Barnes & Noble versus Amazon.com, you're still going to go to Barnes & Noble. They're not going to, you know, Amazon will pay and do this thing. They're too smart to cause that issue. No, where it's going to show up is in other places, like political places, like strikes or inflammatory. I mean, for instance, without net neutrality, this is, you know, this might sound hyperbolic. I probably shouldn't say it because of rhetoric. But in a Black Lives Movement or a black shooting context, without net neutrality, it'll be much easier to shut down and clamp down, if there are riots in Ferguson, to simply not allow the transferring and sharing of videos that would create more riots. You know what I'm saying? So in a net neutral version where you can share information much mm-hmm. more easily. But the flip side is, they're obviously too smart for this. It's all going to be on the back end. So you're still going to get to go to Barnes & Noble and Amazon. Amazon's going to be paying your ISP, and your price of your ISP isn't going to go up. Are you following me? So in other words, Facebook, Amazon, the payoffs are all going to be hidden from the consumer, because they know the day that the disappearance of net neutrality becomes obvious to the consumer is the day they're in trouble.
Well, do you two things. One is this remarkably different? Like whenever you go into a bricks and mortar bookstore or you go to a grocery store, every square inch of the store is sold. And if you think of that as like, you know, the local Kroger or Food Town or ShopRite is an internet site, everything there is sold, like all of the placement. There are very decisions. Yeah. And is that a bad thing, or do we need more literacy to know, more transparency to know that when you're, you know, Tide is placed in a better location because they've paid for it, and that's going to affect your decision? Or is that system actually, it generates winners and losers and products that people tend to like more than others? I mean, is there something, if it's wrong to have kind of product placement or jerry-rigged advertisements or, you know, presence online, is that any different than what we do when we go into, you know, restaurants and bars and supermarkets?
Well, two responses. The first is that your grocery store is regulated, right? Because it's in a zoning area. And if I want to open up a grocery store right next door or somewhere else, I have to do rent seeking. I got to talk to a politician. I got to figure it out. So in the example you just used is exactly like sort of the question we're looking at in that sense. But there's also there's always the option of leaving the store. There's always the option of whatever. Whereas this would be the equivalent of only one store in your town because of the ISP, because of the whatever. Or I guess you could say if you went satellite or tried something else. But it's a lot more difficult because of the other thing is the habituation of shopping in that store. But the second part of what you're talking about is ultimately philosophical. It's not really regulatorily, because it makes me think of the economist Julian Simon, who said the only way to beat advertising, truly the only way to beat advertising, is to walk into a store, walk to the category you want, close your eyes, and randomly pick a brand. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you can go completely random in your supermarket, you can beat the entire commercial and advertising industry. That's the only way. There's no other way. So, for instance, you can't close your eyes and reach out because you know the fifth shelf up from the floor is purchased. It's the most purchased shelf by brands is the eye level shelf. And then the second most expensive are the end caps. So that's a philosophical question to me more than a
And I guess this it presumes that that there are pure goods that will fail or stand, and by goods I mean also sites and services and things that will stand or fall based on their virtue. But you know, like when you buy a book, the publisher chooses a particular book because they think it fits with their overall catalog and it's a quality book and they're going to be able to sell it, and they put more money into it because they think it's a good bet. I mean, somewhere lurking in all of this, there is a very deep suspicion, it seems to me, of advertising and marketing, not as something that gives customers or consumers more information, but is conning them always and forcing them to buy stuff that they don't really want or they don't really need. I guess I'm a little bit uncomfortable with some of that because it's not always the case. And I know, and I suspect you know this as a writer, like, you're competing with a million other people for attention, and you want to get your stuff out there, in the best form possible, in the best, in the best perch possible, so people can see it. And to the extent that you're going to dress it up or spend time polishing it, like, that's actually a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fascinating that you say that. I mean, I'm ultimately what you're talking about is this question of persuasive power and how we communicate, and that kind of question. But you, where I differ from you slightly is, we both agree that the power over our behavior has been way too exaggerated. This goes back to War of the Worlds and all kinds of other questions. Let's be honest. Zuckerberg is in front of Congress for only one reason, and that is Donald Trump is president. He's not in front of Congress. If Hillary Clinton is president, he's not in front of Congress. We're not having this discussion. And it's exactly what you talk about. It's the fear of the behavioral consequences of the persuasion we're exposed to today. And Facebook happens to be the face of that. And Cambridge Analytica fits that model perfectly. And I tend to be, like you, skeptical of a lot of these behavioral and persuasive things. But then there's other issues, like you just raised the question of, well, they think the book in the marketplace will do X, Y, and Z. Well, books now are printed in China, okay? And it's very hard unless you do print on demand. And so there are books. Here we are in April 2018. There are books now being printed in Chinese factories that say New York Times number one bestseller, okay? That won't be shipped to the United States for 6 months to 8 months from now. Okay, this is all the publishing industry, because of the way it goes through distribution, because of the way it works out its catalogs, it's completely rationalized. And so we don't know if that book is going to be a New York Times number one bestseller, but they're going to ensure it is, because it's going to be in every airport in the United States. It's going to be in every airport. It's going to be in every bookstore. And Amazon.com is going to be paid to list it as a New York Times bestseller. The entire system is not a true marketplace. In that sense, it doesn't matter whether the book is good or bad. In that sense, it's about access. It's about distribution. It's about production. I mean, the obvious. There are so many commodities that are so distorted. And here's where I'm very libertarian. Milk, right? Milk is produced. The same cows produce the same milk, goes into the same truck, drives to the same distribution center. There should be zero branding of milk. It's the exact same product. Everywhere you go, it's regulated by the state and it's regulated federally. And yet you walk into a store and there are 30 different types and brands and different pricing of cow's milk. It's bizarre. And the fact that the expensive version of milk beats the cheap version of milk, I'm not talking about organic, I'm not talking about any of that, I'm talking about the very specific brand, tells us that there is something to this behavioral aspect. Like, why would anybody pay $3.70 for a gallon of milk when literally the exact same product is in there.
Maybe the picture on the carton gives them a nice feeling. You know, it's sometimes, and I know that this is, sometimes those companies have better return policies, or they seem to have a different, guarantee of freshness. I don't know. But but then we get to the question of like why we should all want exactly the same thing, right? People want what they want. And I guess then that's the question that we're kind of getting at in a sideways of like, why do I want something different than you? And how much of that is an expression of me, and how much of it is something being pushed on me by a shadowy marketer or a system that kind of drives me to make this choice rather than that choice?
And the question of the shadowy marketer that you just mentioned, I'm curious what the libertarian sense is of exactly what I just discussed, is kind of channeling the way the distribution channels, because there's rent-seeking in distribution channels, there's rent-seeking in marketing channels. I just don't presume fair marketplaces in this sense. I mean, if you want to publish, publishing is a great example. Sure, you can self-publish with Amazon. Go for it. You know, whatever. But your chances, the entire marketplace, I would argue, is rigged against you, and rigged against you in ways that your own tax money is being employed against your success. Through subsidies,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I agree with that. But there are chances, and it's also what, I know people who... who are professional journalists who prefer to self-publish books because they don't want to go through the process of the types of editing that they get, at a more conventional house, which minimizes the ability of the book to do well. It doesn't wipe them out, but it changes the odds quite a bit. And I find that kind of interesting, because this is also like when I think a lot of times in terms of rock and roll bands, when, a certain band will refuse to sign with a large label because they want to maintain a certain amount of control of their material and their look and all of that kind of stuff. And it's a trade-off. What's interesting to me now compared to, 20, 30, 50 years ago, is that there are more options to do it yourself, and you can find an audience more easily than in the past. But it's all trade-offs. And I guess my only beef with you on this is that some of that stuff, like the editor at an established publishing house or the talent agent, who finds the book, the editor, the designer of the cover, they tend to add value. A lot of the times the value that they might add is exaggerated, or it was valuable 5 years ago, but it's not so valuable now. But a lot of those processes that kind of winnow out or sand off rough edges or force people to revise and rewrite and things like that, they have actual value that comes out in the final product that makes it better and hence more likely to sell.
Well, music is a great example, and I'd like you, because it's a terrific example. Do you think it's easier or harder today for your average band to break through? See, I would argue that the market is so distorted, a band can't bring a cassette to their local radio station because there's nobody at the local radio station.
There are no local radio. Yep.
Yeah, I'd say it's much, much harder to break through, to book gigs out of town, any way you want to say it, whether it's airtime, book gigs out of town, that the market is totally distorted now in music. I think music is way ahead of publishing,
but
way ahead of all
yeah,
the
no,
other
it, yeah, and I agree, because the old model fell apart first, because of Napster, and actually even before that, because of, by 2000, certainly, for a couple thousand dollars, you could buy a studio that was better than anything the Beatles were sitting in. But having said that, like if you go to places like SoundCloud and you go to places like YouTube, you can get distribution immediate, and it's, I have a 16-year-old son, him and his friends, like they listen to SoundCloud more than anything, and they're listening mostly to, rappers who, may or may never get very big, but they have an audience. And there are, in southwestern Ohio, where I spend part of my time, there are rap shows every weekend, even in farm towns and stuff like that. So it's a different model, and it's, I don't know that, there will always be the kind of Rolling Stones or the Beyoncés and whatnot who are doing it in a way that calls back to the kind of rock god status, I think. But there are a lot of workarounds. And I think it's easier to, most musicians I know say that it's easier to make a living as a musician because you can tour, you know, you can get gigs in a way that it was harder to do, say, in, you know, the 1980s in places like New York or L.A.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, no, and, you know, and then, and but it's, you know, it changes. And I mean, and I guess also, you know, the question is then, does music always have to be kind of analyzed in terms of how close it is to a model that we might have grown up with as a business model or as a distribution model? Or is the real question, is there more or less music available now, more or less new and old music available? And it seems to me we're very much in a kind of horn of plenty situation.
Yeah, and that in its own way could be distorting the marketplace too, in a good way. So
yeah.
It's two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. So to bring back to media literacy, what is, you know, let's wrap up and just, you know, talk us out with, you know, what are the, how do you see your students? You teach students and younger Americans. I was looking at a recent poll that came out and it said about 70% of people under 30 are unengaged in politics. They watch a fair amount of, you know, video, you know, they're living in social media. Do you feel like they are developing critical attitudes towards social media? If so, what forms are those taking? And if not, what forms should they be taking?
Well, it's interesting. In my students, it's sort of a fascinating paradox in that they're so overwhelmed with media in a way that other generations weren't, that they do have a level of sophistication that is impressive. That's the first part. But the second part is they're also so exposed to, like we say, these algorithms designed to please them that they don't have the same sort of universal critical thinking that generations before did. So, and part of that is just the loss of kind of a universal culture. In other words, they can live in their own worlds much more easily today than they did before. The other thing is demographics, okay? You know, Facebook is grandma's Christmas card now. Facebook is gone in their generation. Twitter is for professionals who are lucky and already got jobs and already did this kind of thing. You know, Twitter is an employment thing. It's not a fun thing. Instagram and Snapchat, which actively remove political content, I mean, Instagram with the link thing and Snapchat with the dual thing, they, you know, it's a bummer in that way, in the social media way. So they, you know, they're social media savvy in one sense. And they also know, here's a very interesting privacy thing. Are you familiar with the term Finstagram with an F?
No.
What it is it's fake Instagram. Every student has one. They have the Instagram that mom and dad can share and find, and they all know each other's Finstagram. And this is a privacy surveillance. This is a level of skepticism in privacy and surveillance that I really appreciate that they've learned, you know, that in other words, of course, it's not private for real,
right,
but that they're realizing they're being watched. They're realizing that social media is a surveillance machine. So it's impressive. So it's a kind of paradox in that way. But, you know, I'd like to see more skepticism. You know, to me, one of the great losses in American culture is Mad Magazine.
Right.
You know, Mad Magazine at its height in the 60s and 70s had 2 or 3 million copies a month being sent out, teaching kids about advertising, teaching kids about the news, teaching kids about their authorities. You know, it was better than The Simpsons in that sense. I don't see any real equivalent of that in today's world, you know, educating kids with a funny, humorous, sardonic kind of perspective in that way, that I think is really missed in our culture. I think, we need some form of media literacy to step in, and we need to make it interesting, we need to make it funny, we need to make it engaging, and we need to make it shareable. Putting it in classrooms won't work.
Right.
It just won't work.
But I mean, I felt
like Mad Magazine will.
Yeah, I felt that South Park was one of the shows that served that function pretty strongly, you know, that it created critical readers or critical thinkers out of its viewers. But I agree that, you know, it's almost the creation of a critical apparatus is going to have to come from within the medium that it is critiquing. And maybe that'll be the next great movement, the auto critique coming out of, you know, out of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and all the rest.
Yeah. Think about if you turned on the TV between 1968 and 1972, how sophisticated for both teenagers and adults the Smothers Brothers were about television, the All in the Family and the Lear sitcoms. Regardless of the political position, what they said about the media was absolutely essential for people to learn. I'd love to see Facebook, Twitter, and the others figure this out and do it in a way that hopefully would work.
Yeah. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Michael Socolow. He is a professor of journalism and history at University of Maine. Mike, thanks for talking.
Thank you.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening. Please rate and review us while you're there.